So we're on page 19, chapter 12, verse 1. Lech Lecha. So as we said, we met Abraham fleetingly at the end of last week's Sedra. We learned of his birth and his early years, but it's all dealt with. Very weak, please. And no milk. Inflation.
You're very well, by the way, Mr. Potter.
Yes, thank God for that.
Pardon?
You're very well.
Yes, thank God,
yeah. Would you like one of these? Because I've shifted them to the middle.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Not very
much. So, we begin to learn about Abraham in earnest in this week's Sedra. And in fact, it's mentioned in Hayom Yom, which is one of the Lubavitch publications. It was actually produced by the Rebbe in 1942-3, a little diary, if you like, but each day there's an aphorism or saying or you know, some nice idea. It's usually a quote from the writings and the sayings of the previous Rebbe.
Thank you.
And there, the Rebbe talks about how the first two Sedras, Bereishis and Noach, are mixed. They're mixed in their sentiments. Bereishis starts off happily with the creation, but then there's the sin of Adam and Eve and the snake, and then finally at the end of the Sedra we learn of the calamitous situation where mankind became corrupt and was deserving of destruction. The Sedra Noah is all about the flood and the calamitous events there, but only at the end of the Sedra does the mood lighten and we begin to learn about our forefather Abraham. And in these next two, three Sedras, we read in much more detail about him and his great achievements. What was his greatest achievement? Was the fact that he alone, in an environment of idol worship, recognized God. And we're told that he did this at a very early age. He was only 3 years old when he... Child prodigy, yes. I mean, there are child geniuses. It's not out of human experience that there are child geniuses. Lahavdil, we have Mozart, who was playing a concert or something like the age of 4 or 5 on the piano with his sister. So we do have precedents for great genius, even at a very young age. So it's not a wild idea. And we're told that at the age of 3, he began to ponder, because he'd been brought up in an idol-worshipping society.
Brought up until 3? I suppose it's different years then, was it?
No, I think at the age of 3, a child can be inside up like that, can't they? They can be self-willed.
If the child is greatly blessed with deep thinking and a great brain, they can be very sophisticated at the age of 3.
There. I think the character's there at the age of 3.
Well, I just cited you an example of Lahavdil of Mozart. But... he began to think, and he started to think about the fact that the world seems to be a very organized place on the basis of nature. And he began to ponder as to where this world has come from. And he thought there must be a power that is directing this world, created the world. And he thought, well, maybe it's the sun, because the sun shines with all its power and glory. And then he saw that even though the sun rose, the sun set. So the sun has lost its influence. And then he thought maybe the moon, maybe the stars, maybe the other powers, the wind and the oceans. But each one of them, he realized, has its limitations. So he suddenly began to realize that there must be an unseen power which transcends all of these material, physical powers that we perceive and see and experience. Because, as we said, they all have their limitations. And he came upon the idea, there must be an unseen creative power. And he decided that this was the truth, which of course it was. And, thank you, and incredibly, he had tremendous self-sacrifice for this ideal. He latched onto it as he matured. He realized that it's the truth, and that idol worship is empty, is meaningless, is false, is misleading. These are not deities, these are not powers, these are not gods. There must be one divine being, invisible, who is the source of all creation and all harmony and order and the physical law. Now his father, who was called Terach, was an idol worshipper originally. And he saw in his son a rebel. And in fact, he decided, he was too rebellious for his liking, and he decided to denounce him to the king. Now the king was called Nimrod. Nimrod was the root of the word Nimrod.
Shall we know Nimrod from
Nimrod?
You might have heard of the word Nimrod because it's the name of a bomber. I think one of the bombers during the Second World War.
One of the British bomber types was called the Nimrod. Planes, wasn't it?
It was a plane, yes.
There's someone at the head of Kadima, actually, at the centre.
I know that man. There's one, somebody at the British centre. Yes. He said to me, my father named me Nimrod after a wicked king. Yeah. He was an Israeli.
Yeah. I think I remember him. Yeah. So it's not really a Jewish name, although Israelis, some Israelis have chosen it, because it's the name of a wicked king indeed. And he's called Nimrod because the root of the word Nimrod is Mered, which means rebellion. And the reason why he was called that, according to Rashi, is because he led mankind in a rebellion against God. There is a concept of Yodea Esubonai Umechavein Limrodboi. There is a concept of knowing one's creator, but having in mind an intention to rebel against him. This is the ultimate in rebelliousness against God, is not to claim ignorance or lack of education, but Yodea Esubonai, someone that's learned, was taught about God and the creation and everything, and then in later life decides, no, it's not for me, and they rebel against God. That is called Yodea Esubonai Umechavein Limrodboi. He knows his creator, he knows his master, but intends to rebel against him. Now this was this Nimrod. And he was a tremendous leader, tremendous personality, and he led the civilized world into idol worship. He made it very, very prevalent. By force, very much like the dictatorial regimes that we've seen in the last century and the century before, that by force made people follow certain doctrines, political doctrines and so on.
Isn't it hard to believe that Chile, that welcomed the Nazis after the war, is behaving in such a humane and wonderful way to these poor miners?
Oh yeah, I read it. I think you don't put the two together, but it always crosses my mind how disgusting they were to accommodate the ex-Nazis. I know it doesn't go together, but it's still the same country, and I wonder how a regime, and Pinochet as well, and how they're bending over backwards. Just as a matter of record, the main countries for harboring Nazi criminals were Argentina and Brazil.
Chile had not as much, I don't think, but they were very dictatorial. 7,000 of them were given asylum here.
You do get contradictory behaviours in even within a nation, but that's not the subject. But anyway,
7,000 were given asylum here. They're all now working in the police and local councils. No, 7,000, when the Jewish people left Germany to get asylum here, they also gave asylum to 7,000 Nazis. And if you look into Brian Gerrish's work, he's gone back the whole history of what's happened as a result of that in this country. It's very interesting.
Well, this story is interesting, but it's not the subject of this C7.
How you can change and become compassionate.
Well, within the same people, you can have compassionate ones and non-compassionate ones. I mean, there were, you know, amongst the Polish people, many of them were anti-Semites. By the same token, some of them protected the Jews. Even in Nazi Germany, there were some Germans that protested and tried to right the wrongs. So it's never a, you know, it's never a single situation in when you're talking about a whole nation. You have a very, you know, a spectrum of behavior. And that's true of, you know, of everybody, really. The rabbis say that you will always have the variables of tzaddik, beinoni, and rasha. That means the righteous, the average, and the wicked. Because the word tzibur in Hebrew means congregation. And it's pointed out in the holy books that the word tzibur is the initial letters of tzaddik, stands for tzaddik, the righteous. The base of tzibur stands for beinonim, which means the average. And resh, the last letter, stands for rashoim, which means the wicked.
So even the most evil people have the power of God?
And thank you very much, Rochel, for mentioning that idea, because it's a very profound idea. That even within a person, you have the levels of tzaddik, beinoni, and rasha. That within our own psyches, and within our own personalities, we have very good points. We are doing mitzvahs, we're doing good deeds, we're being nice to our fellow man and woman. And then we have average behavior, which is neutral behavior, and then sometimes we do wrong things as well. So we're also the very same mixture. This world, as explained in Tanya, is called a world which is Me'urav Toiv V'ra, a world where good and evil are mixed up. This actually harps back to the sin of Adam and Eve. Because originally, Adam and Eve were created as innately good. And the only evil was outside of them. The snake represents the power of evil. But it wasn't inside. It wasn't a temptation coming from within that we experience. It was a temptation coming from without, from outside of themselves. It was a separate force, not within. As a result of falling for that temptation, falling in, God changed the rules, so to speak, and he said, because Adam and Eve had allowed the evil temptation to come within them, and Adam allowed Eve to persuade him, once the snake had done its nefarious work, God said that from now on, the evil will not be a snake that's over there. The snake will be inside us. We all have a battle going on between good and evil inside our own breasts. Our own breasts.
Our dark side.
The Tanya describes the heart as having a good side, And a bad side.
The thing is, Mr. Kodesh, everybody, human beings, people, all human beings, there's no such, I don't think there's such things, but everybody's got their good points and you've got your bad points as well.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, so that's
exactly, you've summarized what I'm saying.
That's what I believe.
So,
I want to be all good. You can't believe
we all want it to be all good.
I don't think it's possible.
It's not possible.
And because the rabbis say that a congregation is made up of tzibur, tzibur meaning a congregation is tzaddik, beinoni, v'rasha, it's telling us that this is a norm which God has created, and it's what we have to run with. We have to run with that situation, and we have to better it, we have to improve it, we have to work on it, and we have to make, as I was taught in school when I was a wee little lad, good, better, best. Never let it rest until your good is better and your better's best.
A man of words and not of deeds is like a garden full of weeds.
Right. So we have to work on it. The whole aim of why we've been put in this world is to work upon this tension that's within us of the powers of good and evil. So what you described as happening in Chile, and what we described as happening in Britain, that they brought in Jews and Nazis, and that within every nation you've got good people and middle people and bad people, it's happening inside ourselves as well, and that's what we have to work with. That's the challenge that God gave us. And every step we take in the direction of good.
I'm just thinking that.
Every step
of the way.
Don't eat manic, eat organic.
Every step we take in the direction of good is tipping a balance. You can see the Maimonides comes out with the most graphic and amazing scenario. He basically says every person has to realize the power of their own deeds, because we have world-shattering power. Not world-shattering, but world-building. And he describes the following scenario. Imagine...
Power without responsibility. That's what it is.
No, it's power with responsibility. Yeah, look, just let me describe the scenario. The Rambam Maimonides describes the world as being on a seesaw. Teetering in balance. Not more good than evil, and not more evil than good. It's just in the middle. And I myself am on the middle of this seesaw. I'm also half-half. I'm half good and half not good. And my next deed will tip the seesaw one way or the other. And Maimonides says every person has to consider themselves to be in that situation. That my next deed is going to tip the world one way or the other. And we know that on a seesaw, on a balance, you can balance a pound against a pound weight, a ton against a ton, or a million tons against a million tons. And one feather will overweigh it on either side. So it's not the magnitude of the deed that we're talking about. We don't have to do something great and earth-shattering. It could be a small good deed, making a blessing before we eat something, saying amen when someone makes a blessing, uttering a prayer, learning some Torah, coming to Project L'Chaim, attending synagogue, doing a favor for your friend, or doing a favor for your enemy, even better. Doing a favor for somebody that you don't particularly like. All of these things show that our whole aim is to tilt the earth, tilt the world in the favor of good. And to cope with this situation, as we described, of Mu'urav Toiv Bara, where evil, good and evil are mixed up together. And our job is to extract the good from this mixture and separate it out and, emphasize it. So Marion, you raised a very good point there, which integrates beautifully with the Sedra. Because this was Abram's achievement. In a world that was dominated by evil at the time because of the idol worship, he brought in good and godliness. And the two words are related. Good and God are related in English. The reason why good is good is because God has decided what is good. Good is good because of God. It's not man's decision of what is good. It's God's decision of what is...
So we've all got the Yetzer Hara.
We've all got the Yetzer Hara. You put it in a nutshell. Let's go on. Vayomer Hashem el Avram, lech lecha, me'atzecha, u'mimoyladetecha, mi'beisavicha.
So do I. No, not you, I mean me.
God... It's your temper, and that's nasty.
Me?
No, not just you, I'm thinking about myself. And I don't lose my temper very
much. Listen to these words, because inadvertently we've stumbled across the crux of what Jewish life is all about in this sentence, and as raised, the point that's been raised by all of you about how we see in nations the mixture of good and evil. God said to Abram, go forth from your land and from your birthplace and from the house of your father, El Oretz Asher Arecha, to the land which I will show you. So God is telling Abram to move from where he is and go to the land I will show you. Later on, we are informed the land I will show you is, of course, the land of
Holy Land.
Of Israel, of course. But it's not yet told to him. To increase his reward, to make it tantalizing, that he doesn't quite know where he's going yet. But once he gets there, I mean, well, once he starts on the journey, God reveals to him, of course, where he's going. But let's analyze these words. Go forth from your land. Your land, your birthplace, and the house of your father. Now, this summarizes the challenges which we all have in our lives to extract the good from our situation. Because the books on ethics and Hasidic teachings point out that these words, may Arzacha your land, Molartacha your birthplace, and may Beis Avicha, the house of your father, are kind of allegories to a much deeper concept, each one of them. They explain as follows. May answer, it's saying, God is saying to Abraham, I want you to move away from where you are now and put yourself in a different position. Move away from where you are and improve your spiritual situation. Where are you now? May answer, you're in a land. Now the root of the word Eretz is the word Rots, which means to run, and it's connected with the word Ratzon, which means will. And Rots and Ratzon are connected as well, because we run to that which we want. When we have a will for something, you know, you see children liking ice cream, they run to get the ice cream. They like a sweet, they run to get the ice cream. What you want, you run for. So the word Rots meaning run, and Ratzon meaning will or wish, are deeply connected. And it's also connected with the word Eretz, because the root of the word Eretz has got these two letters, Reish Tzadik, Rots, run or will, in it. So what it's saying is, God is saying to Abram, you up till now have had your own will in life, of what you want from life. But I want you to go away from that. I want you to reconsider as to whether what you've wanted up till now has been the right thing. In the light of what God is going to tell him about what is right and what is wrong, maybe what he wanted before isn't so good after all. And that's the first level of evaluation that we must do within ourselves. We all have will and wishes, aspirations, ambitions. It's all expressions of what we want. But we have to measure those aspirations against what the Torah wants for us. Do they fit in? Do our aspirations fit in with what the Torah aspires for us, which is what God wants? So God's first message to Abram is, you've got to be willing to move away from your own desires and will. And then you can be a proper servant of God. If someone is wallowing in their own desires and their own preconceived ambitions, they've got a barrier between them and God. Because God expresses himself that he wants one thing, and this person is saying, no, I want something else. That's stage one. Stage two is moladetcha, your birthplace. Now what does this signify? Molad, what we're born with. Every person is born with innate characteristics. Everyone's different. Some people like chalk and some people like cheese. Some people like wine, some people like beer. Some people like music, some people like mathematics, some people like Torah, some people like walking, some people like sitting. We all have, now where have these come from? Where have these ideas come from? These sort of predilections. We're born with them. Everyone's born, you know, there's a saying in Hebrew, in Ivrit, Al tam v'reach ein v'itfakeach. That means on taste and smell, there's no debate. One person say, you know, I love peanut butter. I hate peanut butter. Where does it come from? Inborn. Marmite. We all have these inborn. Marmite. I love Marmite. I hate Marmite. You know, whatever subject you will raise, you'll get a whole spectrum of feelings about it. I love it, I hate it, and everything in between. Where's it come from? It was born. I never learned it. It was born. It was born in me. So God is saying to Abram, there's other aspects of your personality, inborn traits, which maybe people say, well, I can't help it. This is how I was made. I can't help it. I can't help losing my temper. This is how I was made, to quote you. I've never seen you lose your temper anyway, I don't believe you.
I don't lose it very, very often.
You don't lose it very often.
I don't.
And I hope when you lose it, you don't find it.
I hope I never do.
The alchemy of it, you can transmute it.
Well, you can transmute it with herbs, and you can also transmute it by learning books on ethics and learning to control these natural instincts. Let's finish the point, because we have to finish the shiur very shortly. Yeah. The third thing is mi base avicha, from the house of your father. Now, what is that? That, again, the deeper meaning of that is that God is saying to a person, there are other things which you have acquired from your education, your family. There are certain attitudes which are not built in. They come from our parents. Our parents had certain attitudes which in turn came from, or maybe they developed them, but they very often hand them on to their children. You know, I go out on the mitzvah tank. We go out every week, twice a week.
It's called an enneagram.
I don't know that word. So we go out on the mitzvah tank. Now there's a certain gentleman in the Golders Green. He comes to the mitzvah tank to put on. Well, he doesn't want to put on tefillin. He argues for an hour, and then maybe the end he'll put on tefillin. Now this man is an absolute out and out communist. He is a rabid communist. Now, he definitely wasn't born with that. Communism is not an inborn trait. Where did he get it from? His father was a rabid socialist. Absolute extreme. And he picked that up from his father. Interestingly, his mother was much more traditional, and she sent him to cheder. So this man, he knows the Shema, and he can daven, and he's a rabid communist. And on a good day, he'll put on tefillin, and on another day, he says, I'm not interested. But what I'm trying to bring out is, why is this man a communist? Because his father was a socialist. And why did he pick up things from Cheder? Because his mother sent him to Cheder. He's a mixture, he's a strange mixture. It didn't come from within. It came from his environment, mi beis avicha, from the house of your father. So it's God's third message is, the third thing you have to cope with, and the third thing you have to overcome, is educated attitude.
It's your parents.
It's your parents. If your parents have brought you up in the right way, according to the teachings of Torah and the commandments, and they've educated you in a moral way, then you don't want to fight your parents, because they've educated you the way the Torah wants you. But sometimes our parents give us things which are contrary to what the Torah is demanding of us. So God's message is, let's summarize. The first one is our own desires, innate, inborn. Sorry, our own desires. No, desires are not necessarily inborn. Our own desires are things, ambitions that we want in life. The second thing is inborn traits, which everybody has.
Chicken soup.
Which are very raw, unless they are...
butter beans.
Unless there's some kind of moral guidance. And the final thing is acquired attitudes from our parents, our school, our environment, which may have put us at a tangent to what the Torah really was. So the message from this first piece about Abram is, if you want to be a loyal servant of God and go according to his desires and guidance, then we have to be prepared to give up on those three areas that we may have collected. In other words, the baggage.
Chocolate
the baggage containers. That we've collected
cheesecake.
From our youth, from our babyhood, youth and education and early adulthood. And we come to a realization, I want to keep the Torah, I want to keep the mitzvot. We have to do a re-evaluation. And it's not easy. These inborn habits, these habits of a lifetime, they're ingrained very, very deeply. And to eradicate or to harmonize and convert their energies in the right direction It, don't underestimate it. It's very, very difficult. So, but this is the message to Abram. To be a good Jew, which is what Abram was, the first good Jew, is to take up the challenge in these three areas and to succeed. And that's what Abram did. He threw away his innate desires. He threw away his will, his own ambitions. He threw away his inbuilt, inborn traits, and he threw away the lessons that he learned in his father's house, because his father taught him that idol worship is the way to go. So Abram was the first Jew to show the way in this divine task of converting the world into a godly place, and we do it by conquering, first of all, ourselves.